pass them out to thousands of people in that convention center. That's only one part of what is in Project 2025. You know, they're talking about effectively, you know, programs which effectively are for unserved communities. Of gutting that, the Department of Education as well, limiting different types of visas that, which allow for pathways for citizenship into this country. It is systemic all the way through. It would impact not only Latino communities, but other immigrant and minority communities across the country. And not just minority communities, it would impact a significant number of non-Hispanic whites because it really cuts across socioeconomic factors as well.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. Juan Proano is CEO of LULAC. He was speaking to us from Miami, Florida. And Cesar Espinosa is executive director of FIEL in Houston, Families of Immigrants and Students in the Struggle. You can see all of our segments on the Republican and Democratic National Conventions and Immigration and Project 2025 at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Support for the KBOO Evening News comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland. Grendel's serves coffee, tea sandwiches, and more. Information is available at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Portland's new police oversight system faces a key hurdle in court on Thursday.
New findings show American police injure at least 100,000 people each year.
And of Portland Fred Meyer workers take to the picket line for a week-long strike.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 28th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Portland's new police oversight system faces its next and potentially final legal hurdle tomorrow. The city will present its code package in a fairness hearing to determine whether it meets the oversight requirements of the city's settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Judge Michael Simon has been presiding over the settlement agreement for many years. He will decide whether the code package put together by the city is reasonable, fair, and adequate. Judge Simon will have the option to send the proposal back to the city for further work if he feels it does not meet the needs of the settlement agreement. That includes requirements around transparency, community involvement, record keeping, training, and other areas. The city's oversight proposal is a drastically scaled back and altered version of the one put together by the All-Volunteer Police Accountability Commission, or PAC. The altered proposal has prompted persistent criticism from many former members of the PAC and other advocates for strong police oversight.
For example, the original PAC proposal would have had the Independent Oversight Office investigate nearly every complaint that wasn't an administrative HR matter. The city's version includes a much narrower scope. KBOO compared the city's jurisdiction proposal with case data from the Independent Police Review, or IPR, and found that under the city's plan, the vast majority of cases would not be investigated by staff of the new office, but by police internal affairs. IPR Director Ross Caldwell told KBOO that some of these complaint categories are, quote, squishy, due to the variables specific to each case, and so it is difficult to make an exact estimate of the percentage of complaints that would go to either the new system or internal affairs. Under the city's plan, IA decisions would be reviewed by the staff of the new oversight system, but not the Volunteer Citizen Board that oversees it. There is no mechanism to appeal IA decisions or decisions of the new board. This would be the first time in 40 years that the police oversight system would not have a pathway for the public to appeal findings in misconduct cases. Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch submitted a written complaint to Judge Simon ahead of tomorrow's hearing. Handelman is a former member of the PAC. He wrote, quote, "The letter brings up a number of ongoing concerns with the city's reworked proposal, including language prohibiting bias for or against police for board members, a requirement that citizen volunteers do a ride along with police, as well as the narrow limits on jurisdiction," end quote. Tomorrow's hearing will be at 9 a.m. in courtroom 15B of the Federal Courthouse in downtown Portland. Members of the public are welcome to attend, but recording is not allowed.
Police in the U.S. use force on at least 300,000 people each year, injuring an estimated 100,000 of them. That's one of the findings in a groundbreaking data analysis on law enforcement encounters from the nonprofit research group Mapping Police Violence. The group launched policedata.org today, a new database cataloging non-fatal incidents of police use of force. The data builds on past reports that U.S. police kill roughly 1,200 people each year, or three people a day, a death toll that has crept up every year. In 2022, Mapping Police Violence found there were 1.2 uses of police force reported for every 1,000 residents. There were more than 8,000 incidents of chemicals being sprayed, more than 4,000 cases of people hit by weapons like batons and beanbags, and more than 2,000 cases of contacts with canine dogs. Of the 31 agencies that disclosed whether people were armed when they faced police force, 83% of them were unarmed. Also in 2022, Black people were subject to overall police use of force at a rate 3.2 times greater than white people. Salima Hankins is an advisor to the United Nations Anti-Racism Coalition. Hankins said, quote, "It is politically expedient for candidates to be seen as tough on crime, law and order, in a way that does throw poor people, Black and brown people, people with disabilities under the bus," end quote. Mapping Police Violence obtained its data on use of force incidents from more than 2,800 agencies covering nearly 60% of the population.
Portland area Fred Meyer workers are on strike for the next week because of alleged unfair labor practices committed by management against them. At least 45,000 workers will be out on the picket line until the expected end of the strike on Tuesday, September 3rd. Union leaders urge the public not to cross their picket line and to shop somewhere else during the strike. They filed an unfair labor practice charge against Fred Meyer on August 20th. Saying the company refused to provide, quote, "essential information for current negotiations," end quote. The strike affects 28 Fred Meyer stores across Portland, but it does not extend to Kroger-owned QFC.
There have been 229 cases of whooping cough in Clark County this year, more than the last 5 years combined. 80% of those cases have been just this summer. Health officials worry that, with children returning to school, whooping cough will spread more rapidly. The Oregon Health Authority said there were 178 cases reported in the state between January 1st and the end of May, a nearly 900% increase over the 20 cases reported in the same time period last year. Whooping cough is spread by breathing, sneezing, and coughing, and is highly contagious. Early symptoms, like the common cold, include runny or stuffy nose, a mild cough, and a low-grade fever. But after about a week, more serious symptoms emerge, particularly violent, sustained coughing. Infants are at the greatest risk for serious complications, even death. Vaccines are widely available, though 65% of this year's whooping cough cases in Clark County were not vaccinated.
New polling shows Americans believe the upcoming presidential election will have a major impact on the future of the U.S. Supreme Court, and one legal expert contends the nation's foundational institutions and principles are being challenged like never before. Kathy Clardy Patterson is a council member with the nonprofit Courage for America and is also a lawyer. She says the scandal-plagued Supreme Court finds itself at an inflection point. She adds the court's legitimacy depends on the confidence that people have in it, but says that's something that has been plummeting recently because of rulings by the high court.
I have said to friends, I don't even know why I went to law school, because all of the rules look like they're being skirted. There's no adherence to precedents anymore. They're taking fictitious plaintiffs. They're dealing with hypotheticals that are not before the court.
Just last month, President Joe Biden laid out his plan to reform the court, which includes an enforceable code of ethics, term limits for justices, and a constitutional amendment that would limit the justices' recent decision on presidential immunity. But skeptics say it's unlikely Biden can get his proposals over the finish line, with a divided Congress and with less than 150 days left in office. Clardy Patterson argues he has taken the important first step to incite change and that he remains hopeful. Fewer than half of Americans have a favorable view of the court, while just over half say they have an unfavorable one, according to the Pew Research Center. While Republicans are more likely to view the conservative majority court in an approving light, Clardy Patterson encourages discouraged folks to fight against the idea that change can't be achieved.
But if we become active, if we raise this in discussions with our friends, our neighbors, our family members, and in turn, we become engaged with our members of Congress, we can make a difference.
Clardy Patterson argues everything is at stake. Data show that most Republicans support Biden's proposals, but they only expressed that support when they didn't know Biden was behind them.
Whether it's regard to bodily autonomy, whether it's regard to workers' rights, the environment, there's not an issue that's not on the table. That's why it's so critical.
That was Kathy Clardy Patterson, an attorney from Courage for America.
Sure.
Welcome to 2024 Talks.
That's okay. Georgia Democrats asked Governor Brian Kemp to investigate election board members allegedly colluding with Trump campaign as Trump praises board members by name at a Georgia rally. Special counsel Jack Smith flies a new Trump indictment and Facebook's COVID roll at issue again. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If we fail to protect our state democracy, our sacred democracy, we will risk falling into chaos.
Georgia Democratic Representative Lucy McBath is urging Governor Brian Kemp to investigate three state election board members. The Democratic Party is suing the board, saying members are colluding with former President Donald Trump's campaign to potentially block certification of this fall's election. Under two new rules backed by the Trump allies who control the board, it could say there were voting problems and refused to certify county results. Democrats argue that would violate state law and overstep the board's authority. Trump praised three board members by name at a recent Atlanta rally.
They're on fire. They're doing a great job. Three members, Janice Johnson, Rick Jeffries, and Janelle King, three people, are all pit bulls fighting for honesty, transparency, and victory.
Meanwhile, special counsel Jack Smith has filed a superseding indictment in Trump's federal election interference case, slimming the charges down in light of the recent Supreme Court immunity ruling. The substance of the charges remain much the same. Describing them a year ago, Smith said Trump was accused of conspiring to defraud the United States, disenfranchise voters, and obstruct an official proceeding.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
In a statement on Truth Social on Tuesday, Trump called the superseding indictment an effort to resurrect a dead witch hunt. Trump has named anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and former Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard honorary co-chairs of a possible transition team. The two former Democrats and fringe presidential candidates have both endorsed Trump. Kennedy told right-wing commentator Tucker Carlson that he's been asked to work with Trump's sons should he win.
I've been asked to go onto the transition team and, you know, to help pick the people who will be running the government.
Trump had previously criticized Kennedy's extreme views on vaccines. In a letter to Republican firebrand Congressman Jim Jordan, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg said senior White House officials pressured his social media company to censor COVID-19 content during the pandemic. In a House committee meeting this spring, Jordan read a previous text message from Zuckerberg. Jordan said it showed Facebook was censoring a theory about the virus's origin.
Can we include that the White House put pressure on us to censor the lab leak theory? That's the question Mark Zuckerberg asked in a group text with the top people at Facebook.
Zuckerberg's text came after President Joe Biden claimed misinformation on Facebook was killing people. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Emma Renee Derning from the Rural Organizing Project about the organization's work to educate and support rural Oregonians ahead of the 2024 election. Then, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. Tonight, we'll get an inside look at the creation of a new limited series on KBOO, running on air. At 6, it's The Underground, produced by KBOO's own youth collective. Then at 7, PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear, with an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny, with a high of 90. Today in history, in 1898, a beverage created by American pharmacist Caleb Bradham that was called Brad's Drink is renamed Pepsi-Cola. The name comes from its advertised use to relieve dyspepsia, or indigestion. The quote of the day is from Canadian writer Robertson Davies, who said, "It is mankind's discovery of language which more than any other single thing has separated him from the animal creation. It might be said that until he developed language, man had no soul. For without language, how could he reach deep inside himself and discover the truths that are hidden there, or find out what emotions he shared or did not share with his fellow men and women?"
The USDA is providing emergency grants to tribes because of supply chain crises. That crisis has backed up government-supported food distribution programs, and it's having a significant effect on indigenous communities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some government-backed food distribution programs are having supply chain issues nationwide, which is having a significant effect on indigenous communities. In response, the USDA is providing emergency grants for tribes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has the details.
To address the lack of food access caused by supply chain issues, some communities, like the Navajo Nation, will receive over $5 million to obtain food locally. Spokesperson Justin Hostein says the Navajo Nation plans to use the emergency funds to create more farming opportunities to promote food resiliency. This will allow them to move away from preservative-filled food items to food that is also culturally enriching.
And traditional diets like cornmeal, flour, beans, potatoes, and get that out to the people so that they have better quality food, but food that also is part of our traditional diet.
When their local farming effort is fully functional, the Navajo agriculture production effort will be able to provide food delivery for nearly 50,000 residents. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Minnesota's new free college tuition program may help Native students pursue higher education, as Mike Moen reports.
This fall, the state launched its North Star Promise Initiative, where households earning below $80,000 a year qualify for free tuition at state colleges and universities. Experts say limited scholarships are one of the many obstacles Native Americans encounter in the world of higher education. White Earth Tribal and Community College President Anna Shepherd doesn't sense the new program will lead to a big enrollment boost, but for students receiving the aid, it could take their college journey to greater heights.
What I really appreciate is that they're not going to have to graduate having debt. And so maybe they're going to pursue a master's or doctoral, so then they don't have to worry about that.
She says juggling student loans and other college debt often limits Indigenous populations from obtaining advanced degrees. Research from the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute shows that between 2010 and 2020, there was an 18% decrease in graduate enrollment among Native Americans.
That was Mike Moen reporting. A measure to include tribal voice and knowledge in natural resource management heads to California's governor. Under the measure, the state's Natural Resources Agency would be authorized to enter into co-governance and co-management agreements with federally recognized tribes. It was introduced by Assemblymember James Ramos. Ramos says under current law, the agency is not required to work with tribal communities. He says the bill fosters government-to-government relationships and authorizes the state to begin negotiations on agreements with tribes within 90 days of a request. The bill has support from a number of tribes and conservation groups. The governor has until the end of September to sign or veto bills passed by the state legislature. This week, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced more than $10 million to provide rental assistance and supportive housing services to Native American veterans. The funding is intended to help veterans who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. Through a HUD program, vouchers are made available for housing, case management, and other services are provided by the VA. According to HUD, the program has helped more than 1,000 Native veterans. The new funding allows about 500 veterans to remain housed and offers housing opportunities to more homeless veterans in tribal communities. The latest round of funding is going to tribes and tribal housing authorities across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Portland Water Bureau is building a filtration plant that will be able to filter ash and sediment that could spill into waterways after a wildfire. Extreme weather events are leading to more and more wildfires, even in areas where they were not expected. This year, the state already broke records after wildfires spread across 1.5 million acres. Climate experts say cities that rely on rivers and streams for drinking water need to prepare for what's ahead. And Portland is one of only a handful of major cities that doesn't put its water through a filtration plant. This will change. The city will finish building a $2 billion filtration plant east of Gresham in 2027. Some residents have already questioned if this new expensive system is necessary. Oregon's dense forests produce significant amounts of high-quality water via their significant watersheds, or collections of rivers and streams fed by rainfall and snowmelt. And many of Oregon's dense forests are relatively resilient to fire. Rainforests can also act as a natural filtration system, and forest floors are thick with pine needles, leaves, and other plant materials that serve as a natural water filter. Unlike many other ecosystems, Oregon's soil remains absorbent after a fire, so contaminants don't flow directly into streams. But wildfires can still dump ash into waterways and can destroy shade trees, causing waterways to warm and ferment toxic algae and bacteria. A fire can also burn plant roots which hold in soil, triggering landslides.
Researchers have seen changes in Oregon's forests. Invasive pests are killing trees, making it harder to keep water cool and soils intact. Some waterways are seeing increased sediment that an associated electrical charge can attract heavy metals. Sediment can also react with chlorine, a chemical used to treat drinking water, to create a cancerous byproduct. Eugene has already had a robust filtration and treatment system that clears potential toxins and sediment that flow down the McKenzie River. In 2017, Portland city leaders opted to invest in an expensive filtration system that promised to remove sediment after wildfires, earthquakes, or other natural disasters. When the system was first approved in 2017, city officials estimated it wouldn't cost more than $500 million. That price has since soared past $2.1 billion. A vocal contingency has gone to city council meetings to protest the project. Some are concerned about increasing water rates, others about potential noise and congestion during construction. Some don't want their natural water to run through a filtration plant at all. Portland Water Bureau staff say the filtration plant is on schedule to be completed by its state-mandated September 30th, 2027 deadline.
Washingtonians apparently want to drive electric vehicles, and a new rebate program from the state is providing some proof. Earlier this month, the Washington State Department of Commerce launched its EV Instant Rebates program. The agency's Clean Transportation Managing Director, Steve Hershkovitz, says the program is designed especially to reach low- and middle-income residents. He says EVs are nearly at price parity with gas-powered cars, but the vast majority of transactions for vehicles of any kind is for used vehicles.
So it's just very difficult to break into the new vehicle market, and we wanted to make it more accessible for low-income families who are used to buying on the used market disproportionately.
Hershkovitz says the program focuses on leasing, providing a $5,000 rebate for the purchase or lease for 24 to 35 months of new EVs and a $9,000 rebate for leases of 36 months or longer. Rebates are $2,500 for the purchase or lease of used EVs. Hershkovitz says the program has provided more than 1,000 rebates since the start of the month, 2 to 3 times the agency's expectation. Rebates from the program can also be added to federal credits for EVs. But Hershkovitz notes that there are many restrictions on which EV models are available for federal credits, which is why the Department of Commerce is focused on leasing.
Leases do not have the same restrictions because of the way the Inflation Reduction Act language is written. And so that was one of the reasons why we emphasized leases so much, was to maximize how much of those federal dollars are coming into Washington State.
Hershkovitz says the rebate program's success isn't surprising.
There's a tremendous demand for electric vehicles, and it's really showing that price has been a barrier for a lot of people. A program like this that is on the consumer demand side of the equation is really important for being able to speed up the pace of uptick.
That was Stephen Hershkovitz with the Washington State Department of Commerce.
Groups that fight for more humane treatment of animals worry that labels on fresh fish that say humane or sustainable are little more than an attempt at greenwashing. Suzanne Porter has more.
Labels on fresh fish marked humane or sustainable may not be telling the whole story, according to animal welfare advocates. Fish shoppers are increasingly looking for an environmental seal of approval. But Dr. Helen Browning, who lectures on animal welfare at the University of Southampton in the UK, says fish labeled sustainable means the species was not overfished, but says nothing about how the fish was raised or if it suffered a painful death.
And so I think that could be quite confusing for consumers. You know, they might think that humane products are sustainable, sustainable products are humane, when actually, you know, neither of those things have to be the case.
The Monterey Bay Seafood Watch Guide is an online tool that shows consumers the species and regions that are fished responsibly, covering wild fisheries and aquaculture operations, with an emphasis on environmental sustainability, not humane treatment. 15% of the world's wild-caught fish are certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. But Jackie Marks, Senior Communications Manager for the MSC, notes it does not address animal welfare.
The MSC is a nonprofit organization focused on sustainable fishing with healthy populations, healthy ecosystems, and maintaining legal and management requirements. And we're not experts in seafood quality or animal sentience, so that really sits outside of our mission.
The Aquaculture Stewardship Council published its fish health and welfare criterion 2 years ago. ASC spokesperson Maria Casanera says the guidelines lay out best practices for fish farmers.
The group called for certain welfare considerations, including anesthesia of fish during handling operations that can inflict pain or injury if fish are moving, and maximum time fish can be out of water.
Some national animal welfare groups are promoting the idea of humane slaughter for fish, which aims to reduce or eliminate the fish's pain and suffering. Currently, many fish are chilled to death in an ice slurry or asphyxiated by being taken out of the water before being stunned or killed. This story was produced with original reporting by Jessica Scott Reed for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is trying to take a break from the future.
Take a moment to breathe. School started for the young, but most colleges weeks away. September will begin nearing 100 degrees, as August did, and think how fairly mild this August was. But who can say for September or anything? Is Donnie being cagey, only pretending to lose whatever grip on reality he still had? He's threatening to not debate. Miss National Television? While Kamala asked to keep the mics on, giving Donnie more rope. Mpox vaccine is finally getting to the Democratic Republic of Congo, a place our cell phones depend on. The world's largest wetland is burning in Brazil. Israel bombed Lebanon to take Gaza off the headlines. Russia and Ukraine keep playing Red Rover with their border. Will the next war be something long simmering or a sudden surprise? Take a moment to breathe. Have one of your favorites for dinner. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 28th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, Sam Bowman, and Jasmine Moss. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Catherine Carley, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Porter, and Eric Gladys. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yerkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's an election year, and a lot of focus is being placed on the presidential election, but it's not the only race that will have an impact on people's lives. A lot of that comes down to state and local elections, and in order to make the best decision on where to cast their vote, voters need information. That's where the Rural Organizing Project and their Stand Guide come in. To learn more about that, I'm speaking with Emma Renee Derning from ROP. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for stopping by to talk with us about this. So we got to get some primer.